Hi, this is Kevin Lewandowski from Discogs, celebrating 750 million records in our global collection. You're listening to the Your Morning Coffee podcast with our friends Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart, weekly music news for the new music business.
From Rolling Stone, will Congress ban TikTok? Here's what's going on.
From Music Watch, results of the Music Watch 2023 annual music study, record numbers of music streamers and paid subscribers.
And for Billboard, vinyl sales keep growing. So why does it look like they've dropped? Well, Jay, just when you think TikTok's biggest problem is their little tiff with Universal Music Group, oh no, they've got a lot more problems. So we're going to talk about all of that stuff. Jay and I are so glad you're here. We're going to start the show right about now.
Stand by for transmission.
This is London Calling.
Wake up! The revolution is at hand!
Your morning coffee is on the air.
Your morning coffee, the weekly music news for the new music business. It's the highly curated, agitated, advocated, moderated, and liberated digital music information that you need to know. We are your digital music authority. And now, from our studios in Hollywood, California, here's your hosts, Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart.
Jay, it is good to see you on a lovely day here in Southern California. I am sneezing and blowing my nose because we've had wonderful rain and now the pollen is here.
The allergies.
I'm a sneezy, snotty mess.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
But you're back from South by Southwest. It's good to see you.
Yeah. Yeah. And how about that that cool introduction from Kevin Lewandowski? He's the CEO of Discogs.
Indeed. Love to hear that. And I love Discogs, of course. And the Discogs collector community just surpassed a new milestone in music collecting. Across a variety of formats, genres, and countries, the global Discogs community, utilizing the Discogs collection tool, hit 750 million releases cataloged.
Wow.
That, to say the least, is a lot of records.
Yeah, I love Discogs. You know, they're currently featuring things like albums turning 35 in 2024, and that includes like Nirvana's Bleach and the Beastie Boys' Paul's Boutique, 35 years old. And things like
right.
Five hi-fi albums you need to hear with a new cartridge. It's just such a great place to go if you're a music freak. And so they have some milestones that you just touched on. Here's some other interesting numbers from Discogs. The average collection size is 200. The largest Discogs collection is 634,000 items. That's a big collection. The most collected artist, The Beatles, with 4.7 million collected. And the most expensive release in a collection, Prince, the Black Album, and the average price of that is $27,500.
Wow, that is a lot of money. So what does your record collection mean to you? Last year, Discogs surveyed over 50,000 Discogs collectors about their collections and the motivation behind their collector's journey. This handful of quotes represents a small cross-section of Discogs collectors. So folks certain people said it's all about the emotional connection to the music and the artist. I agree with that. It's a great way to pay tribute to the music that has influenced me greatly. It's a passion as I am a music lover. Others said, I'm replacing and building the collection I had in my youth. And who doesn't do that?
Mm-hmm.
And others said, it's just everything. So, you know, we are I resemble that remark, right, yeah. Jay? It's, we love collections and we love cataloging and having all of that stuff at our fingertips, and it's just fun to geek out.
Yeah, and it reminds me of something Will Page told us, and I don't know if he came up with it, but it was something like, you know, your record collection is who you are, your book collection is who you want to be.
That's a great line. It's a great line. Well, and he pointed out when we chatted with him too, is that, you know, we talked about that stat about how many, what percentage of people that buy vinyl don't even open it. And we were somewhat, I don't know, critical of that. But he said, you know, look at, he said, listen, in his library, he said, I have a lot of books that I purchased that I haven't gotten around to reading as well. So it's not so bad if you buy vinyl and don't listen to it, but it is... It's kind of different,
yeah,
for me anyway. That's the first thing I want to do is tear into it when I get it.
Well, yeah, but they're saying that, you know, about half of the vinyl that's purchased is purchased by people who don't own a turntable. But as Will pointed out, you know, almost 80% of people who buy books don't read those books. You know, they have them on their bookshelf. They're meaning to get to it. And we were talking about that, and I'm looking at my books, you know, you can only read so many books at a time, and I've got lots that I haven't gotten to yet. So
yes,
anyway,
yes.
Super interesting.
Yes. Well, Jay, let's talk about South by Southwest. I'm going to guess you had a pretty darn good time.
I had a good week, and you and I have been talking for an hour before we hit record, and I told you some of the stories from South by. It was just such a great week. Got to see some really... you know, see some old friends, see some new friends, hanging out with Scott Pappas over there at Disney Music Group, our friends from Luminate. I got to meet Scott Ryan, which was pretty cool. I had a wonderful coffee meeting with Jamie Marconette from Luminate, and we solved all the industry's problems over a cappuccino. That was cool. Symphonic has a sort of a shindig every year, and it was just so great to see all those people there, Randall Foster and Michael Burrows and the great team over at Symphonic. I was telling you about a dinner that I had with Bill, Fred, and Andy from Flatiron Records, and Will Page joined us. By the way, happy birthday, Will. And hilarity ensued. That was a highlight of...
That's a dangerous crowd. And the, yeah. Hopefully there was no alcohol being consumed, because then that would just...
I cannot confirm nor deny. Okay. Saw some cool showcases, performances. I saw Bree Stoner. She was awesome. And I did a couple of panels. One, I was a panel guest, and the other, I was the panel moderator. The panel I was a guest on was called Data and Concert Marketing. I was joined by Edward Castillo from FIO Agency, Emily Young from C3 Presents, Rob Seeley from OpenStage, and that was moderated by Bands in Town managing partner Fabrice Sergent, who we've had on.
Yes,
and right before we went on, my friend Christina Latino was on a panel, and that was great. But the sort of the highlight of the panels for me was a larger panel discussion. I moderated this really great South by Southwest panel called The Evolving Landscape of Record Labels for Artists, because as you and I talk about all the time, the roles and responsibilities of labels and distribution, they're blurring, they're changing, they're evolving. And we've talked about, you know, Sherry Saidi and Versewire. She was on the panel. Taylor Hansen from the band Hansen was on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people may not know that they've been running their own label for 20 years and running it through the Orchards. And then marketing guru Nick Lipman was on. We just had an incredible conversation. Great panel, insightful questions from the audience. And then as I was telling you, you know, I had sort of that Chris Farley moment after the panel as we were leaving. My friend Bill Hine introduced me to Jody Stevens, excuse me, from Big Star.
Oh, my God. I would have melted.
And yeah, it was I wasn't prepared for it because I'm such a big fan. That was pretty cool. So South by Southwest was just a great week. The only negative was as I'm flying home, my plane got diverted from Burbank because of high winds and took me to LAX. But other than that, it was a great week.
That file that under a first world problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good time. I wish I could have joined you there.
It's, maybe next year.
A little envious. Yes, maybe next year. It's been a while since I've been to to South by Southwest. Jay, a great piece, of course, by our good friend Glenn Peoples in The Ledger. This piece was Global Music Revenue Continued to Rise in 2023. So why are some music organizations sounding the alarm? The piece goes on to say the global record business will soon pop the champagne to celebrate another year of streaming-led revenue growth, judging from the handful of individual country revenue figures for 2023 made public so far this year. The IFPI won't release its 2023 report until Thursday, this coming Thursday, the 21st, but major markets such as the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Spain, and Japan have already released data that shows 2023 produced another bumper harvest for record labels. But while streaming continues to push markets in positive directions, growth has slowed, and revenue in some markets remains well below the levels of the CD era. Worse yet, some countries may have insufficient streaming growth to get back to earlier peaks.
That's really interesting. And you just mentioned the IFPI report, which is coming out this Thursday, and we'll talk about it on next week's show. There's two reports. Well, there's a lot of reports that we cover, but two sort of main reports that you and I refer to a lot. One is the RIAA, which is US, and the other one is the IFPI, which is worldwide. And I'm really excited that that's coming out Thursday. But certain territories have been sort of putting out a little bit of early information, and that's what is referred to in Glenn's newsletter, The Ledger, this week. The SNEP, the Recorded Music Trade Group in France, for example, issued a stark warning this week when it announced that the country's 2023 revenue rose a respectable 5.1%. And that's 968 million euros. You know, it's not nothing. And streaming revenue climbed 9.2%, a 10% increase in subscription streaming revenue remains too weak to fully fuel the development of the market, even though it's the primary source of value creation, the SNEP wrote in its 2023 report. You can read the full article on Billboard Pro.
Yes. And as we say, you've got to subscribe to The Ledger if you don't, because there's so much great information.
And it's free.
And it's free, for crying out loud. Come on. What are you waiting for? And Jay, if I'm not mistaken, you're behind the set list with Neil Finn is now live.
Yeah, and, thanks.
Oh, my goodness. Very cool.
Yeah,
very
I'm cool such a huge fan of Neil Finn and Crowded House and Split Enz and everything he's done. And it was a joy to speak with him. That one just dropped. So check out Neil Finn behind the set list. Some really interesting tidbits in there. And I think I was telling you beforehand, we've done about 40 or so of those behind the set list. That's me and Glenn Peoples from Billboard. Done about 40 of those podcasts. You and I, we're closing in on 200, even though this is episode number 188, we've done some special episodes and stuff. So we're closing in on about 200. But Mike Brandvold and I have been doing the Music Biz Weekly podcast, and I'm the new guy. I've only been doing it for like 10 years. And we just passed episode number 600.
Oh my God, congratulations to you both. That is
isn't that
just
crazy?
When you think of, you know, and it isn't, it's, we have so much fun doing this, but it's still, there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes where, you know, a lot of work, and to get to 600 episodes, my God, dude, that is unbelievable.
Thank you. So it's
I'm tipping my hat.
Yeah. And to Mike Brandvold, he was early on in this stuff. But I think with a lot of things, whether it's social media, whether it's release cadence, whether it's, you know, you're live performing. There's so many things in the music business that if you're just consistent, just that consistency can
in life,
yes,
in everything,
can move mountains. And you and I were talking before we hit record that our little show here, the little engine that could, last year grew exponentially. And for whatever reason, 2023 was a banner year for us as far as getting new subscribers. And it's been such a joy to watch and such a thrill. And then, of course, being at South By and meeting people who listen, it was just an honor, and it was very humbling.
Yeah, that is totally awesome. And we say it all the time, but we certainly appreciate everyone who listens in and sends us notes and comments and helps us along. And it's we stand on the shoulders of giants, without a doubt. And
yeah,
that's the listeners.
Yeah. We sure do. And before we get into the stories this week, there was something super interesting on TikTok that a lot of people were sending me. There's a country artist, very talented. Her name is Claire Dunn. And there was a story in Country Now, and the headline was, Claire Dunn exposes the dark side of the country music industry. So again, this is from videos posted on her TikTok, and I want to play you one of them, play you the audio from one of them. And just know that she went to Belmont in Nashville. So she's educated. She was prepared for some of the tomfoolery that sort of happened, and I'll let her sort of walk through what happened with her and what she did about it.
Part one, telling my story of being in the belly of the beast in country music in Nashville. So I had a booking agent where this story all begins. I was very naive at this point in my career, but I was so excited, and I had this agent, pretty powerful person, and we'll call him Charles. And so one day, Charles and I were talking, and I was needing an attorney for, I think it was a publishing agreement or something I was wanting to have looked at. I don't truly recall. But anyway, so Charles recommends this entertainment attorney. We'll call him Bubba. So I call Bubba up. We talk. I hire him. He helps me with whatever the publishing thing was. And I think, great, I've got a little team coming together. And I'm excited. People want to help me. So one day, Bubba calls me up, the attorney, and says, hey, you want to come in and have a meeting with me and Charles? I'm excited because Charles has always been hinting about wanting to manage me. And I was like, okay, Charles wants to manage me. He's well connected. This could be awesome for me. So I go in, and it's me, Charles, and Bubba alone in a conference room at Bubba's offices. And we're chit-chatting. And then Bubba slides a piece of paper across the table to me. And Bubba launches into this whole oration of why I need to incentivize Charles, who's already my booking agent, who's already making his 10%, why I need to incentivize him to continue working with me, stay with me. I'm confused, nonetheless. So while Bubba is yammering, I start skimming the contract. Another thing you need to know is I went to a private school in Nashville called Belmont University. Great school, very expensive for myself to attend. So I was not about to waste any piece of information or knowledge I could gain to equip myself out there in the real world in the music industry. So I paid attention in my entertainment law classes and in my publishing law classes. And what I was taught is, based on the environment, the way it was at the time, it was going to be unlikely for me to get signed to a major label without having to sign a 360 deal. A 360 is where a company or a single person, whoever you sign it with, they own a certain percentage of your all your income revenue streams, whether they have anything to do with them or not. So for example, this would be like owning 20% of your merch, or 30% of your touring, or 40% of your revenue from your music. The percentages can vary, and it's basically just a commissioning, if you will, of all income streams that you have. So what I learned at Belmont is it may be inevitable you have to sign a 360 deal with a major label, but for God's sake, whatever you do, don't sign a 360 deal with anyone else before then. You can be seen in an undesirable way, and it was so competitive, and like you can't do anything to be any less desirable than what you already are. And you gotta hold on to what little of your income you can keep, because it's already, a lot of it is commissioned away. 10% to a booking agent, 15% to a manager, 5% to a business manager, and so on, off the top. So I'm sitting there in the meeting, Bubba is yammering on, I'm becoming very concerned. And Bubba just insists, you've got to incentivize Charles. You've got to incentivize Charles to keep working with you. I want to make this point for clarity, and it got too cold out there. So Bubba is lobbying me to sign a bad deal. And Bubba is my attorney that I am paying, that I have hired to protect me. And yet he is lobbying on behalf of the person he wants me to enter into a bad contract with. Just want to clear that up. I remember very clearly raising my head when Bubba quit speaking. And I just asked him, and it must have been God or something giving me the guts. But I said, Bubba, he's my booking agent, and he gets his owed 10%. He gets it. I have no problem with that. That's what every booking agent in town gets. That's what every artist pays their booking agent. Why do I have to pay more in order for him to keep working with me as a booking agent? He wasn't interested in managing me. He didn't want to manage me. He just wanted to own me. And when I said that to Bubba, both of their eyes got big as saucers. And the energy in the room changed, and it got very tense. And I got very scared, even though I'd done the right thing. And long story short, the meeting was over shortly thereafter. I walked out of there very confused. And come to find out, Charles and Bubba have been longtime friends in town. I didn't know that at the time. So needless to say, I fired Bubba. And I think when I told Charles no, I think, in my opinion, that sparked something in him where he just said, if I can't have her, no one will. And also, in my opinion, I don't want to get sued, but did some irreversible damage to my reputation, all because I told him no. And one other thing in conclusion, I did find out later that this agent had also put another artist into this same type of corrupt deal. That artist went on to blow up, and for how big this artist was, they should have had a massive career for a long time. But this artist's career imploded because of financial strain from these horrible deals that this artist had signed. I knew this artist. I knew people that they worked with. And come to find out, they had signed this same deal. It was all playing out at the time still when he was trying to get me to sign this deal. But this is what happened. So, thanks for watching. Love you guys, and more on the way if you want it.
It's heartbreaking. There's so much talent in Nashville, and there's so much that you have to do to become successful. Again, that consistency. I mean, we always say it starts with a great song. You know, it starts with great music, but everything after that, you know, a lot of people are working really, really hard, and it's really disheartening when you see sort of the dark, underbelly of some of these music business tactics. So thanks to Claire Dunn for, you know, it was very brave of her to sort of step forward.
I was
going to
say that. Yeah, very gutsy move. So yeah, absolutely. Jay, when we put on the show, we have to reach out and thank our sponsors because, my goodness, we could not do it without them. And we are forever grateful for the folks that help us put the show on, including our good friends over at Bandzoogle. For over 20 years, Bandzoogle has made it easy to build a stunning website and online store for your music. Now they've added a brand new EPK plan so that musicians can create a professional single-page electronic press kit in minutes. All the features you need to design an EPK are already built in, including fully customizable templates, preset EPK page layouts, music players, images, text bio, and video embeds, a gig calendar and press quotes, and access to Bandzoogle's award-winning support team 7 days a week. The new EPK plan starts at just $6.95 a month, and your Morning Coffee podcast listeners can go to Bandzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days, then use the promo code MorningCoffeeEPK, that's all one word, to get 10% off the first year of the new EPK plan subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code MorningCoffeeEPK, when you sign up to the EPK plan.
Yeah, and we're also brought to you by Hypebot. Since 2004, Hypebot has chronicled the new music industry and the trends and technologies that are changing how music is discovered, consumed, marketed, and monetized. It's edited daily by founder Bruce Houghton with help from Alana Bonilla. Hypebot and sister blog Music Think Tank are published by live music discovery and marketing platform Bands in Town.
You betcha. Bands in Town, over 80 million live music fans trust Bands in Town to get personalized concert alerts, recommendations, and messages from their favorite artists. It's the number one artist service platform, connecting over 590,000 artists with their superfans. Managers, labels, agencies, and artists access their own dashboard to manage and promote their tour dates across all platforms.
Yes, and finally, the Music Business Association. I'm a member, have been for a long, long time. The Music Biz Conference creates the rooms in which important conversations that shape the future of the music industry take place. Representing more than 90% of the music industry at large, the Music Business Association serves as the connective tissue for the global music business and provides a trusted forum where ideas and collaboration can flourish. Join us for the Music Biz 2024 conference, May 13th through the 16th in Nashville. I'll see you there. I'll be moderating a panel with some really smart music marketers. Come by and say hi.
Indeed. So big thanks to Banzugo Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association. And I am one lucky muchacho because every week I get to hang out with my good friend Jay Gilbert. He is a music industry consultant. He's the curator of the weekly Your Morning Coffee newsletter and a former executive with Universal Music, Sony Music, and Warner Music Groups. Mm-hmm. Not just a pretty face, but the man knows his stuff.
And somebody can't keep a job, and that's me.
behind me.
And, I get to do this every week with my good friend Mike Etchart, longtime host of Sound and Vision Radio, formerly of SST Records, Warner Music, Capital EMI, and Universal Music Group.
And that's just a short list. There were others. All right, Jay. Well, let's jump in. Oh, my God. This has been a crazy week. This first story is from Rolling Stone. Will Congress ban TikTok? Mm. Here's what's going on. So there is a proposed U.S. TikTok ban, a bill that could ban TikTok, and the U.S. now heads to the Senate after the House voted on Wednesday with overwhelming bipartisan support to remove the social media platform from U.S. app stores. The House vote was 352-65, with 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans voting in opposition. Lawmakers supportive of the bill have argued TikTok poses a national security threat and should be spun off from its Chinese parent company ByteDance because the Chinese government could force the company to hand over the data of U.S. app users. Many of the roughly 170 million Americans who use the app have raised concerns about the ban, saying it's where they go to find connection, get entertained, seek information, and earn a living. The bill faces numerous hurdles to being signed into law in the coming months and will almost certainly face legal challenges if it is.
Yeah, so what is the TikTok bill and what is it proposing? The House of Representatives on Wednesday passed the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act. That's a mouthful.
Wow. Yes.
The bill would require TikTok to sever itself completely from its Chinese parent company ByteDance or face a potential ban from mobile app stores and web hosting services. The bill would also create a process through which the president can designate certain social media applications with ties to foreign governments as a national security risk.
So the legislation was introduced by Representatives Mike Gallagher, who is a Republican from Wisconsin, and Raja Krishnamurthy, who's a Democrat from Illinois. Gallagher, the chairman of the House Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party, said in a Tuesday statement that he has one message for TikTok, which is to break up with the Chinese Communist Party or lose access to your American users.
Yeah. So could TikTok actually get banned in the United States? Under the Constitution's First Amendment, Congress cannot outright ban the application in the U.S. without first proving that it poses an imminent national security risk. Lawmakers acknowledge this and contend that the proposed legislation is not an outright ban, but rather a narrow expansion of presidential authority to better regulate the influence of foreign governments in the tech sector.
However, if passed, the bill could functionally mean the end of TikTok in the U.S. The company would either have to separate itself from ByteDance, likely through a sale, or be blocked from the App Store and web hosting services. It's not a direct ban, but rather the creation of a set of conditions that would make it nearly impossible for TikTok to continue operating in the U.S.
Some legal experts believe this would still be unconstitutional under the First Amendment. Earlier this month, the American Civil Liberties Union and several other leading technology and civil rights groups, they issued a letter to Congress warning that the new law would, quote, trample on the constitutional right to freedom of free speech, it's easy for you to say, of millions of people in the United States. TikTok is home to massive amounts of protected speech and association. It enables its users to discuss opinions, share their hobbies, make art, and access news from down the street and around the world. Jeopardizing access to the platform jeopardizes access to free expression, end quote.
So why are lawmakers concerned about TikTok? The bill's introduction was prompted by longstanding concerns that TikTok, through its Chinese parent company ByteDance, could be used to conduct surveillance on Americans by gathering and exploiting user data.
So how does President Biden feel about a potential TikTok ban? The president stated last week that if Congress manages to pass the bill, he'll sign it. Quote, if they pass it, I'll sign it, Biden said. While the bill looks primed to breeze through a House vote, it may be stalled in the Senate, where Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, has yet to commit to bringing it to a floor vote.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said last week that the Biden administration doesn't see this as a banning these apps. That's not what this is, but rather ensuring that their ownership isn't in the hands of those who may do us harm. Where does Trump currently stand on a TikTok ban, and why did he change positions? During his administration, Donald Trump was all in on a TikTok ban. In August of 2020, he issued several executive orders commanding the full divestment of the app from ByteDance and attempting to block any American entities from conducting business with the company. In response, TikTok sued the Trump administration, arguing that the administration had not provided sufficient proof that the app constituted a national security threat worthy of a ban. Trump's efforts were ultimately overturned by President Joe Biden.
Yeah, but Trump is now singing a different tune. On Monday of last week, the former president told CNBC that he wasn't that enthusiastic about the bill currently before Congress. He said, there's a lot of good and a lot of bad with TikTok. But the thing I don't like is without TikTok, you can make Facebook bigger. I consider Facebook to be the enemy of the people along with a lot of the media.
Ugh. Wow. Another reason Trump, the presumptive 2024 GOP nominee, has reversed course seems to be rooted in chipping away at the base of support for President Biden, who pledged recently to sign the anti-TikTok bill. This year, Trump has been shown private polling data showing that many young and Gen Z voters would rebel against political candidates who commit to taking away their incredibly popular app, a source with direct knowledge of the matter, and another person briefed on it tell Rolling Stone.
Yeah, and then there was an article in Mashable, and it listed the countries that have banned TikTok already. And some of these were surprising. You know, Afghanistan, that's not too surprising. The Taliban banned TikTok in Afghanistan back in April of 2022, saying that the platform's content was not consistent with Islamic law. That was according to Bloomberg.
But Australia, on April 4th, Australia banned the app from all federal government-owned devices, citing security concerns raised by the Department of Home Affairs. Attorney General Mark Dreyfus said the ban would be imposed as soon as practicable.
Yeah, and then there's Belgium. Belgium banned TikTok from work phones of government officials. Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said in a statement to Politico, quote, we can't be naive. TikTok is a Chinese company that currently is mandated to cooperate with Chinese intelligence services, end quote.
So up in Canada, mirroring other countries, Canada banned TikTok from all government mobile devices in February of this year. Mona Fortier, president of the Treasury Board, said the partial ban is due to the app presenting an unacceptable level of risk to privacy and security.
Yeah, I see a theme here. And then Denmark. Denmark's defense ministry banned employees from having TikTok downloaded on their work devices in March. Again, related to security considerations assessed by the country's Center for Cybersecurity. Staffers were told to remove the app as soon as possible.
And in India, India made moves against TikTok back in 2020, implementing a nationwide ban on TikTok and 58 other Chinese apps for engaging in activities which is prejudicial to sovereignty and integrity of India, defense of India, security of state, and public order.
Wow. And then there are a few other countries, Nepal, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, and Somalia, all of them have banned TikTok. But there was a piece in Tech Dirt, and there was an op-ed by Carl Bodie, and he said why banning TikTok isn't the answer. So we want to kind of give the other side. He said that countries that care about consumer privacy pass privacy laws. They regulate data brokers and generally hold corporations and executives meaningfully accountable for failing to secure consumer data. T-Mobile, for example, had been hacked 8 times in 5 years due to comically lax security and privacy standards. And I've yet to see Congress lift so much as an eyebrow.
So he said the myopic hyperventilation about TikTok and TikTok only is mostly a distraction. A distraction from the GOP's ongoing quest to turn the internet into a propaganda dumpster fire. A distraction from our failures on consumer protection. A distraction from congressional corruption. A distraction from the fact that we've lobotomized our regulators in exchange for utopian promises never actually delivered.
Yeah, he goes on to say that banning the app may not even be popular 5 years from now, but doing absolutely nothing about the corruptive rot that enables its privacy abuses is a hollow performance that simply doesn't strike at the heart of the actual problem.
Wow. Well, this is things going to be. It was
to be continued.
Really, because I remember it back during the Trump administration, and it's all of a sudden it just seemed to kind of like explode again, this conversation. And
yeah.
Obviously, all of these things are the same thing that Facebook does, the same thing that X, formerly Twitter, does. But you know, I do understand the concerns because this is, you know, it's tied to a country that has shown itself to always be kind of trying to meddle in things here. So,
yeah. And my only concern, Mike, is that anything that gets legislated by politicians who don't have the app, haven't used the app, that concerns me. And there's a lot of misinformation out there. We had covered a piece a while back about, you know, the Chinese were accused of having TikTok data on servers in China, and that just wasn't true. So, you know, there's three sides to every story, yours, mine, and the truth. So we'll continue to, you know, check out these articles and report back from these very smart people.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Our second story, Jay, it's from Music Watch. Music Watch reports results of 2023 annual music study. Record numbers of music streamers and paid subscribers. This past week, Music Watch published its 22nd edition of the U.S. Annual Music Study, the most comprehensive overview of audio and music purchasing and listening in the U.S.
Ah, yes. And I had the pleasure of sitting down and speaking with Russ Krupnik this week. Russ is the managing partner at Music Watch. He's also an adjunct professor at NYU Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. He's just a smart guy that helps the music industry sort of break down and understand these trends. So here is my conversation with Russ Krupnik from Music Watch. Russ, thanks so much for joining us today. Good to see you.
Good to be back.
So this week, big news, Music Watch, the report came out, the annual music study. It's your 22nd edition. It's such a great report. Before we get into sort of the meat of the report, for those that don't know, tell them a little bit about you and how you came about sort of creating these really cool Music Watch reports.
Well, when I started doing research in music, we were primarily doing artist profiling, the kinds of things that Chartmetric does today, except we were doing it in the olden days with pens and pencils and then later online surveys. And, you know, about 23 years ago, clients came to us and said, we need some smart guys who can figure out the actual cannibalization between peer-to-peer and CDs. So when somebody downloads a file from LimeWire, how does that actually statistically impact CD sales? Now, since I wasn't the smartest guy in the room, I went to our stat people and said, how do we do this? And so the very first annual music study was actually called the Peer-to-Peer Report. And we were the first company that actually said, and I frankly, I don't even remember, we said, you know, X amount of file sharing takes this much out of the pie of CD sales. And as you can imagine, over the 22 years, it's evolved from, you know, tracking iTunes, tracking devices, tracking the beginning of streaming, and, you know, here we are today. So we've, the annual music study has actually covered every evolving topic, you know, in the last generation of music consumers.
It's such a great report. And I noticed on the website, there were sort of like a dozen really cool bullet points, because people don't like to read today, but they love bullet points. Talk a little bit about what you learned, and, you know, what it was, there anything that surprised you out of the report?
Well, I one other thing that actually every year when we do the report, there's something that surprises me. I think, you know, if you take a step back from the charts and the graphs, what's really shocking is that the number of people who are streaming in the U.S. has almost doubled in the past 10 years. And even more striking, if I went back to 2013, 2014, there were 7 million people who were paying for a music subscription. 7 million. We're now up to 109 million. So just, it, you know, from a time, I remember giving talks about, will anybody ever pay for music anymore? And it wasn't that long ago. Now we've got over 100 million people who are paying for music subscriptions, and even more if you count Sirius. And I think the other encouraging thing is that, you know, the amount of money that folks are spending on recorded music continues to go up year after year. We're kind of over the past 5 years, it's up about 21%. So, you know, some really, really terrific metrics on that side. And other things, because we get into all kinds of minutiae, you know, piracy and sharing are down, which is great. And I think those, you know, more people paying, less people stealing. The outlook for vinyl, you know, we ask people, what are your intentions? Because everybody keeps saying, when does the vinyl revolution come to a halt? And 9 out of 10 are saying, no, I'm going to keep buying it in the coming year. And I may even buy some more. So I think it's all of those little nuggets all over the place that you know, fascinate me about the report. And I think they're, you know, they're important metrics to the industry, I think.
Yeah, I love the way you put together sort of the recap. One of the points I thought was really great was you said the Walkman dream realized. You know, and talk about, you know, you can have your music any place, anytime. And I remember getting the Walkman, you know, when I first got that, and I could ride my bike and listen to music. That doesn't sound like a big deal now, but it was like earth shattering at the time. And I think really our business is based on disruption, and I mean, sort of always has been. Do you see anything disruptive, if you could put on your, you know, your crystal ball and sort of look ahead? Is there anything that you see that's going to be possibly disruptive moving forward?
Well, I think we're not only looking at the past and the now, we're always looking at what, at every report, we kind of look at what the future could potentially bring. And the things that there are kind of two things. One that concerns me a little bit is kind of the millennials have really been the core of where all of this subscribing and paying has come from over the past couple of years. And we're starting to see evidence that they're capping out, that their penetration of subscriptions is very high. The millennials that are left, they're either on a family plan or they're sharing an account. So their potential is starting to shrink a little bit. And then I'm always looking at, and partially because I are one, I'm always looking at Gen X and boomers to say, you know, how do we get more of them on the paying side? You know, the generation that used to spend hundreds of dollars on cassettes and vinyl and CDs, how do we move them up so that we can keep, it's not going to grow as it has the past 10 years, but how we can keep the growth going, both from an audience and a spending perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thanks so much for joining me today. Love the report. I always learn something every time one of those reports come out. So thank you again.
You are most welcome. Thank you, Jay.
Always nice to hear from Russ.
Yeah, for the sure. best.
Yeah, so here are some takeaways from the Music Watch U.S. annual study. So number one, a growing customer base. The U.S. recorded music category continues to show healthy growth with an increase of 10 million buyers in 2023. Buyers include those who purchase or pay for CDs, vinyl records, digital downloads, or music streaming subscriptions.
Yeah, number two, increased spend. Spending on recorded music increased by 7% compared to a year ago, thanks to expenditure on streaming subscriptions, mainly vinyl and CDs.
And also number three, record numbers of paid subscribers. The number of paid music subscribers in the U.S. hit a record at 109 million, 136 million if SiriusXM and Amazon Prime Music listeners are included. That means over half the population are paying for an audio subscription. That is pretty impressive.
That really is. And number four, more juice to squeeze. There's a potential for additional subscription growth, though 7 of 10 millennials already paid who subscribe. This places a premium on moving Gen Z from free to paid services, as well as converting the older and more resistant demographic.
So number five is the Walkman dream realized. The top reason for music streaming is the ability to listen to music any place and anywhere. Connectivity resonated as a key theme, motivating subscribers. And that is a pretty sweet thing. And you and I remember when that wasn't the case early in our lives. Mm-hmm. And we are so spoiled now to have it.
Yeah, 100%. And number six, happy birthday, hip hop. In 2023, hip hop finally passed classic rock as America's favorite genre, as measured by what we listen to, follow on socials, purchase, interact with on streaming services, or spend money on live events.
The seventh on the list, content opportunities abound. 80% of streamers regularly listen to audio categories besides music. Comedy, current events, and podcasts, yay, podcasts, closely compete for the number two spot.
That's right. And number eight, will the vinyl revolution continue? Nearly 9 of 10 vinyl buyers plan to buy more or the same number of records in 2024, and that's encouraging.
Yes, and then number nine is the end of the trend coming. The TikTok juggernaut continued in 2023 with 8% more users specifically engaging in music-based activities on the platform. Social video accounted for an increasing share of music listening time as well.
Yeah, number 10, dialing in. Music on broadcast radio, while not the powerhouse it once was, it's gained listeners in 2023 and continues to be the number one in-car listening option used by 69% of in-car listeners.
And that would be me. Number 11, pirate ships sinking. Music piracy continues to dampen with fewer overall users getting files from mobile apps, stream ripping, file transfers, and P2P networks. Sharing of streaming accounts is also in decline. That's very surprising.
Yeah. And number 12, the superfan gap with a question mark. 1 in 5, so about 50 million, consider themselves super fans for their favorite artists. I'm one. Yet only 9% of these elite fans purchased a VIP package created by artists for fans, VIP live experience, exclusive CDs, vinyl, or merch, meaning there's opportunity to close the gap between fanship and revenue generation. The good news is that half of these super fans are active spenders. They bought CDs, vinyl, downloads, merch, or tickets to live events at stadiums or festivals within the past year.
And then number 13 is remember the future. Streamers are interested in lots of potential capabilities, from AI to gaming integration and real-time live streams. One of the top features remains high-resolution sound quality. 1 in 3 streamers strongly agree with all three of the following statements. Number one, obtaining the best quality sound is important. Number two, they would be interested in streaming or buying more in high-res or immersive formats.
Mm.
And number three, they'd be willing to pay more for high-res sound quality.
That's interesting because you and I talk about that a lot because we're really into, you know, Dolby Atmos, Sony 360, that immersive audio.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I tend to think that the masses won't adopt it until it's their only choice, you know, that that's what's coming across their DSP. But Of course, that's my opinion. I could be wrong. Thank you, Russ. Russ Krupnik, thank you, Music Watch, for another insightful report. One of our favorite reports. Great information.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It's fun to get the snapshots and see where everything is. And good stuff. Absolutely. Yeah. And our last story from our favorite friend over at Billboard, Glenn Peoples. Vinyl sales keep growing. So why does it look like they've dropped? It starts by saying at many of the more than 1,500 independent record stores in the U.S., vinyl sales have been growing at a healthy clip for almost a decade, up 14.2% across all retailers in 2023 alone. That's according to Billboard's data provider Luminate. So why did Luminate track 47.3% fewer vinyl sales in January and February than it did in the same months in 2023?
Well, on its face, such a drop might appear troubling and puzzling, given the surge of vinyl sales since the pandemic. But in actuality, the decline is mostly the result of Luminate changing the decades-old methodology it's used since Billboard adopted SoundScan's measurement system back in 1991 to count sales at indie retail outlets, a change that Luminate had warned last year would make 2024's vinyl sales numbers appear significantly lower. But some of the drop reflects a protest by independent retailers against that adjustment, which one indie community executive worries, quote, may put a damper on one of the industry's high-profile feel-good stories, end quote.
Yeah, so frustrated by the methodology change, some of these indie stores have stopped reporting sales to Luminate, and the Coalition of Independent Music Stores, the Record Store Day Board, the Music Business Association, and other organizations have launched an alternative chart to measure physical and vinyl sales. There are consequences to every decision, Music Business Association President Portia Sabin said in a statement.
Yeah, until the end of last year, Luminate extrapolated indie retailers' physical album sales using a methodology that weighted actual sales by a small sample of independent stores. Approximately 70 accounts totaling 140 storefronts. Billboard estimates that that represented 1,500 to 2,000 retailers of that ilk that are operating in the United States, according to label and distribution sources. So last year, physical purchases such as vinyl, CDs, you know, at those indie stores, even with weighting, accounted for less than 3% of total music consumption in the United States.
So indie retailers say they don't oppose more accurate measurement of their sales. Rather, they are incensed that Luminate stopped weighting sales before it onboarded hundreds more indie music retailers. Instead, in January, Luminate began basing indie physical sales solely on the actual sales retailers report, which due to the protest has been cut in half to about 33 accounts with 70 storefronts that Billboard estimates. Indie stores say they are protesting because of concerns that they, as well as indie labels and artists who rely on them for marketing, will lose influence if their sales suddenly appear significantly lower across the board.
Yeah, and indie label executives and their distributors say that they too are worried about the methodology change because it might affect the marketing of developing artists. Quote, we are extremely disappointed that Luminate chose to stop weighting indie retail sales without launching a serious program to enlist store reporting and to count the physical market, end quote. Matador Records president Patrick Armory, he wrote that in an email, independent labels and independent artists over-index in physical, and especially at indie retail, and we need a level playing field with the majors to measure success. Luminate is penalizing serious career-building, album-oriented artists on the charts. Their sales are not being counted. Their market share is being allotted to the majors. That is a disaster for independent musicians, labels, and retailers.
So an additional concern is that smaller sales numbers and less weight on the Billboard charts, which are based on Luminate data, will diminish the importance of the physical market to the music business ecosystem, as four independent record store coalitions and indie retailing giant Amoeba Music put in a statement issued in October. The worry is that less music will be released in physical formats, which would financially hurt indie retailers. But a record label executive says given the booming demand for vinyl, by the way, that's a high margin product for labels. Mm-hmm. Don't forget.
Yeah.
Those fears are unwarranted. Right now, says one major label executive, with the high prices that the growing vinyl format commands, labels are printing dollars with healthy profit margins.
Yeah. Indie retailers, many of them iconic local businesses that have served their communities for decades, have panicked ahead of big changes in the past when the major record companies decided to change the official release date, you know, from Tuesdays in the U.S. to match that worldwide Friday street date. They did that back in 2014. Indie stores told labels, "You are killing us," recalls a major label executive, and yet no stores disappeared in the aftermath of that change. That sounds to me like you're comparing apples to chainsaws.
Exactly. So some chart mavens say the boycott could be a risky move. By intentionally shrinking their influence on Billboard's charts, indie stores could drive fans who, thanks to social media, are much more attuned to the metrics that determine chart positions to start shopping at sites or stores where they know their purchases will benefit their favorite artists.
Yeah, that's a good point. Artists and record labels hoping to climb Billboard charts, meanwhile, might opt to stage meet and greets and other store promotions at businesses that report their data. Though plenty of acts and record companies still host such events in stores that don't report to Luminate.
So in response to the protest, Luminate says it's working to lure back stores that stopped reporting and onboard a critical mass of indie merchants that have not reported their data before. Stores that have stopped reporting are now permitted to bypass Luminate's standard 4-week onboarding process if they commit to reporting data for at least a year. For the latter, Luminate offers an instructional video and a written guide to the process, although indie merchants say they have pressed for personalized assistance and simplified reporting requirements.
Right. Luminate also recently hired respected veteran music data executive Chris Muratori, and he's the new director of partnerships. Muratori worked for 18 years in various positions at Luminate's previous iteration, Nielsen SoundScan, and more recently founded Border City Media, the startup behind music consumption data tool BuzzAngle Music, which has been folded into Luminate, a subsidiary of Billboard's parent company, Penske Media Corporation. Anyway, he will focus on building and maintaining relationships with the independent music retail sector to ensure physical music sales data is that collection is accurate and as representative as possible. And that's according to a release announcing his appointment.
When Billboard began tabulating charts using SoundScan data back in May of 1991, mass merchant sales, such as those by chain stores and later internet or other mail order operations, were based on actual sales. But the data company used weighted samples of independent store sales data because not all stores back then had the POS or point of sale technology, nor the capacity to transmit store reports. So to compensate, stores were assigned weighting depending on how many other non-reporting stores were in their DMA or designated market area. But over the years, that process became more difficult and less scientific as thousands of stores closed, some sources say.
Yeah, using data from a confidential Luminate report shown to labels, Billboard estimates that last year, the data platform counted each album scanned by 140 indie retailers as 8.54 physical albums. That's that weighting. Based on that extrapolation, Luminate reported that an average of close to 72,000 physical album copies, vinyl and CD, sold each week, totaling 31.9 million copies sold in indie stores in the year.
So overall, in 2023, U.S. physical sales totaled nearly 87 million copies, of which almost 50 million were vinyl sales, while 36.8 million were CDs. Of that total, indie stores, when they were still weighted, accounted for almost 37% of sales. Non-traditional, which included internet, mail order, Christian retailers, and stores like Urban Outfitters, comprised of 41.5% of physical sales. Mass merchants like Target and Walmart, 16.5%, and chains like Barnes & Noble, 5%. As a result of the methodology change and boycott, Luminate reported 40.2% drop in total physical sales, that's including vinyl and CDs at indie shops, chains, and big box stores, for the last for the first 8 weeks of 2024 compared to the same period in 2023, from 13.6 million albums to 8.1 million. Within that, indie store sales fell 95.4%. Wow, from 5.71 million albums when weighted last year to just 262,000 copies.
Wow. Meanwhile, the aforementioned unweighted average weekly physical sales of nearly 72,000 averaged reported by indie retailers from January to November 2023 are now averaging 27,000 per week for the first 8 weeks of 2024 because of the stores that have stopped reporting to Luminate.
As this conflict continues, it's worth noting that vinyl sales keep growing, and that's exciting. Even if indie store vinyl counts were eliminated for the first 8 weeks of this year and last, Luminate's Connect system indicates that year-to-date vinyl sales for the other non-weighted store sectors, we're talking chain, mass merchants, internet mail order venues, and non-traditional retail, are still up nearly 7%. And the vinyl sales bonanza record store day that was launched by independent record stores way back in 2007 is slated for April 20th. Less than 6 weeks away.
Yeah.
I can hardly wait.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. So we'll follow this really closely. Great article, again, by our friend Glenn Peoples over at Billboard. We should probably title this the Glenn Peoples episode,
yes,
since we're covering two of his great pieces this week. But just an embarrassment of riches this week in your morning coffee. Check out the newsletter. So much to cover. We could only cover a few stories, you know, on the podcast. Just an amazing week of music news.
Well, and as I'm reading all of this stuff, I remember back to 1991, and we were both very young men as this was happening, and you were still in sales, as I recall.
I was working at Tower Records in 91 when this all broke.
And it was, I mean, it was, there was a lot of consternation, shall we say. There was a lot of just like, oh my God, this is, you know, a pain. But these things always get worked out. And, you know, it's amazing. Now we have so much wonderful data to see really what's going on. And that's the good news. So on that note, we're going to wrap up the show. Jay and I certainly appreciate everyone listening. And if you enjoy our show, if you would just tell one friend, I know we would both appreciate that. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors. Big thanks to Banzuko, Hypebot, Bands in Town, and the Music Business Association. And you all listening in, Jay and I certainly appreciate it. And we are super happy and stoked we get to do this every week. So on that note, we're going to say thanks for listening. And we'll be back next time, next week, that is, on the Your Morning Coffee Podcast.
You've been listening to Your Morning Coffee, the weekly music news program for the new music business. Join Jay Gilbert and Mike Etchart next time for the digital music news you need to know.